relationships, contrasts exist between the two groups. Now, the first important point is that God did not set out to split mankind into different groups. Indeed, he made three or four efforts, depending on how you count, to reach all of mankind equally. It's only after those efforts failed that he chose a two-tiered system, the Jewish people playing one role, everybody else playing another role. So, let's take Adam. Adam and Eve were given a challenge. If they had succeeded at that challenge, it would have been over. They embodied within them the whole of mankind, the whole of humanity, and the perfection of humanity would have taken place in one shot. There wouldn't have been any distinguished groups, at least not the way we know it today. Okay, he failed. Now, says Ramchal, we enter the period of roots. And here's the idea. The real challenge was in the environment, in the status of Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. As we said yesterday and the day before, failure meant reducing the world tremendously, lowering the world the whole stage. Now, we're supposed to face the lowered world and its challenge, and through what we do on that level, produce enough that can carry us back through the upper stage and to perfection. But, if we are totally cut off from the previous reality, if we have no relationship to that reality, then there's nothing we can do at this stage which would produce the perfection that was supposed to have been accomplished on the level of Gan Eden. Here's my analogy. Suppose, God forbid, there were a disease which produced blindness, and it spread throughout the whole world, and everyone in the world became blind. I don't think there would be any chance to recover vision. I don't think there's any possibility of recovering vision. But let's imagine that that disease affects everybody except 100 people. 100 remain with vision, everybody else without. Then you have a chance. Even if the 100 aren't doctors, but there are blind doctors who can teach them, you have to tell them what to do, you can explain to them how to use the instruments. And then the 100 with sight could discover and carry out a procedure for restoring sight to everybody else. But if everybody's blind, it's going to be lost. There's no way to recover. Similarly, in this case, you need people who have an inherent connection to the Gan reality. They're not living there. They're not immortal as the people who are there. But they have to be connected to it.
Therefore, God has upon the chosen.
Sorry?
Therefore, God has upon the chosen.
No. No. Not at all. We're only up to stage two. I said there were three or four, right? We're only up to stage two. So God made available a period of roots in which anyone, through his own efforts, could achieve that connection to the higher world. In other words, God made that potentiality available to everyone. And conceivably, everyone could have achieved it. The only one who did achieve it was Abraham. But it was open equally to everyone. That was second shot. Third shot. I'll take a three, but I'm counting now. When God gave us the Torah at Sinai, He offered the Torah to every other nation. Now, here many people make a mistake. It doesn't mean that he offered to them in place of us. It means he offered to them in addition to us. Of course it was meant for us. But everybody else could have joined in and been part of the revelation. And also, you need to know, the offering to them was done in the way that it was offered to us. How was the Torah offered to us? When did we get the offer and choose to say yes? When Moses came to us a few days before the revelation of Sinai and said, God has the Torah, we want to give it to you. Do you want it or not? And we said, Sa'asa v'nishma. We will do and we will hear. This is not that God revealed himself. No, he sent a message through Moses. Likewise, he sent a message to every nation on the earth through its leader, through its prophet, through someone that it recognizes. And they all said no. But here was a third attempt to reach everyone in the world equally. God tried three times and was rejected three times. Then he opted for a two-tiered system. We said yes, the other said no, so therefore he gave it to us. In that way we became chosen. We became chosen because the offer came to everybody and we're the only ones who took it. But even now, the door is open to everyone. Everyone can convert. There are no limits on how many people can convert. The door is open to anyone who wants. So it's not as if God said, I'm choosing these, I'm rejecting the rest of you. I'm choosing these. I'm, so to speak, imposing it on them. A born Jew has no option to step out. There's no way that he can become something else. The present Archbishop of Paris is Jewish. He was born to Jewish parents, hidden during the Holocaust with a Christian family, and ending up Catholic, pretending, practicing Catholicism. But he's just as Jewish as you and I are. This group has it, so to speak, imposed upon them. Everybody else had the option. And by the way, I think this is very important in understanding and defending the concept of the chosen people. Many attack the chosen people as a kind of aristocracy, a kind of nobility, a kind of thing that good democratic people aren't supposed to believe in. Good democratic people are supposed to reject as immoral. I think that the distaste for aristocracy or nobility is built on the fact that those concepts are hereditary and only hereditary. You're an earl because your father was an earl. You can't opt to become an earl, except the last 60 or 70 years or so, where you can buy earlship. English titles are for sale because they're, starving England. They've got to use their only titles to shore up the sagging economy or something like that. Anyway, if it's hereditary, if it says we have special privileges and no one else can get in, that could be regarded as vicious. I understand. It's kind of like a caste system in India. But if you say that this group has special position, special responsibility, special privileges, special status, special value, yes, all of those things, and the door is open for anyone to join, I think it's hard to make that into a vicious proposition. Indeed, in modern thinking, a person who has more options is usually regarded as better off. Now, a born Jew has zero options. He's born a Jew, that's how he's got to live. What I did here is I turned it down. I raised the thermostat so it wouldn't be quite so strong. I wasn't looking for more strength. Thank you very much. I appreciate your thought. A non-Jew has several options. He can live up to the commandments that the Torah requires of non-Jews. He does that, he gets a share in the world to come, an eternal reward. He can add mitzvos voluntarily. Jewish mitzvos. He can add them, perform them, and he gets reward for so doing. Like honoring his parents, like giving charity, like according to some, almost all the commandments are available. Shabbos is not available, but according to Maimonides, in one place, you can do anything else. Put on tefillin, keep kosher, blow a shofar on Rosh Hashanah, we'll get credit for all of that. He can do that voluntarily, that's option two. And option three is he can convert. Usually, it is regarded as an advantage to have more options, not a disadvantage to have more options. So, given this background, I think it's going to be a hard task to paint chosenness as a vicious policy proving that we're better than everybody else. So, that's the origin of the chosen to Jewish people. Now, as it stands, there are certain differences. In general, a person is given the capacity to do what he has to do. If one person or one group has to do more, we understand he's given more capacity. Otherwise, it would be grossly unfair. As long as a non-Jew remains a non-Jew, he's required to perform the 65 or so commandments that are addressed to non-Jews. A Jew is required to perform 613. That has to be reflected in a difference of capacity. Mitzvos are the medium of connection with God. We've spoken about this. I don't remember how long ago it was, so I'll just read that very briefly. Mitzvos are the medium of connection with God in two senses. By giving us the mitzvos, he sanctified us. Just by giving them to us, by commanding us, he thereby created for us a certain unique sanctity. And when we perform the mitzvos, we thereby elevate ourselves with the sanctity of the performance. Now, having 10 times as many mitzvos implies, therefore, that there's a very special relationship. Quality and quantity of connection with God that a non-Jew doesn't have. When the verse says, Bonim Atem Lashem Elokeichem, your children to Hashem your God, when God says to eat, to Pharaoh, Bini Bechor Yisrael, Jewish people is my firstborn. By the way, one of the commentators there draws the conclusion, if the Jewish people is God's firstborn, then come on, boys and girls. Then there must be other children. There must be other children, right? Otherwise, you're not talking about firstborn. There must be other children, yes. Other people in the world are related to God as children in some respect or other, just not firstborn. Not that sense.
No, God's children. Yeah.
That's what
I just
said.
There's no other way.
Okay, very good. That's what I just said, right? I think so. However, that implies that the quantity and quality of their connection is less. And how the Tzato in the Way of God, the end of part two, says that the lessening of the relationship reflects itself in the following difference. A non-Jew, by his commandments, by performing his commandments, can affect his own spiritual condition and his own physical condition. Those two are, of course, intimately related, but he makes them two for this description. His mitzvahs have an effect on his spiritual condition and on his physical condition. The mitzvahs of a Jew have those two effects, and they perfect the world as a whole. That ability to affect the world beyond yourself, outside of yourself, that only the Jewish commandments have. So this is a reflection of the difference between the two. By the way, in this regard, I want to mention a particular idea which I've heard stated wrongly any number of times, so I'd like just to put it straight as application of these general rules. The mitzvah of tshuva, regretting what a person has done, resolving to change it in the future, confessing to God, and thereby cleaning the slate. The mitzvah of tshuva, does that apply to non-Jews as well as to Jews? Okay. Proof. Good. Nineveh. Jonah was sent to the city of Nineveh and was told to tell them that they're committing terrible crimes and the place is going to be destroyed, and they repent, reform, they undertake to plead with God, they put on sackcloth and ashes, they fast, and indeed, they're not punished. So you see that tshuva works for non-Jews. Now, suppose someone said, as I have had it said to me several times, yes, you have a proof that tshuva works for non-Jews in this world. That tshuva in this world can remove a threatened punishment in this world. But who says it works in the next world? Maybe it's just stored up for the next world. Tshuva for a Jew takes off punishment in the next world. If a Jew does tshuva, he leaves this world clean. No liabilities. Who says that works that way for a non-Jew? Maimonides says that God took away Pharaoh's free will. God hardened Pharaoh's heart. In plagues 6, 8, and 9, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So the Maimonides, that means he took away his free will. Why did God take away Pharaoh's free will? Because, says Maimonides, God wanted to punish him. He was so evil. He had done so much evil that God wanted to punish him. God didn't want him to escape punishment. He didn't want him to get off scot-free. So he took away his ability to do tshuva. Because had he done tshuva, God would not have been able to punish him. He would have gotten off scot-free. So you see that God's commitment to tshuva is so absolute, someone who does tshuva is free. Now we're talking about Pharaoh here, who's not Jewish. Still, if he had done tshuva, he would have avoided punishment entirely. That shows you that tshuva for a non-Jew takes off punishment even in the world to come.
How do you say that?
What's that? Otherwise, he would have been able to punish him. He could have allowed him to do tshuva, and he could have punished him anyway. He didn't have to take away his free will.
Why did those say that he did the tshuva?
Pharaoh?
Yeah, while he was in the war. I heard a doctor said that he did the tshuva.
Okay, I'm telling you what the Rambam says. Could there be someone with a different point of view? Yeah, there could be. I'm just telling you, from the Rambam's analysis, you see right away, he at least understands that a non-Jew, if he does tshuva, will take off all his responsibilities, including the possibility of punishment even in the world to come.
Why could he say that Hashem wanted to punish him even in this world?
Because that's not what he says. What he says is that he wanted to punish him.
In this world, doesn't
it? It doesn't say. And the Rambam says explicitly in the Teshuva that there are different kinds of transgressions, and that some are punished here, some are punished there, some are punished in both places. Each one is separate. And what he says here is, God wanted to punish him, and he's a Jew, he can't punish him.
So then, why did he take the Omer after 6, 8, 9,
whatever, whichever month it did, why couldn't he do it afterward? After plague number 5, God said, this guy has to be punished. So I can't allow him free will in 6, he might change his mind to do tshuva. Can't allow him free will in 8 and 9, because he might use his free will to do tshuva. No, now if 2 weeks after they leave, God allows him his free will, and he does tshuva, then God is not going to be able to punish him. And after plague five, it's all over. He's got to be punished. So what difference does it make whether it's 689 or 2 weeks later when he's on vacation in the Bahamas?
That's what I'm saying. Like, why did he take his free will away forever? Or?
No, it took away his free will to do tshuva. He didn't take away all his free will. I'm sure he still had free will to order breakfast as he pleased.
Right.
And, you know, and to continue collecting taxes and so forth and so on.
Right.
He just didn't have tshuva to let the Jewish people go and to, you know, rectify what he had done to the Jewish people.
So he does tshuva after that.
If he will have the possibility or the circumstance of doing tshuva, God will take away his free will and stop him from doing it. That's what we learn from 689. He doesn't want him to be able to do tshuva.
What about the rejection that said that Paro was king in Nineveh?
So the Rambam's not going with those rejections. I'm not interested in the history of Nineveh. I'm not interested in the history of Paro. I'm interested in the Rambam's analysis, which implies that if he will do tshuva, it will take off his responsibility for this world and the next.
If it was an adjustment, he would have to give his free will back because he was the one that started the whole tshuva by Nineveh.
Okay, so what?
So at some point he was given that free will back, and if he did tshuva, then he wasn't punished.
So then the Rambam will say, either he doesn't agree with those midrashim, or those midrashim say that God was not committed that he should suffer. Give him another chance. All of this is not relevant to the point that I'm making. The point that I'm making is only the way the Rambam explains why God took away his free will. The Rambam is presupposing that if he will do tshuva, it takes off his punishment everywhere, even in the world to come. So you see that the Nazir has this possibility available to him as well. And in this respect, then his opportunities and our opportunities are the same.
Yeah. Two things. One, we said that it's Nadir is able to do tshuva and be freed. It doesn't mean he has a mitzvah to do it. It just means that he's able to do it.
And I think that's exactly right. Although it would be like all the other mitzvahs of the Torah, which are available but not commanded.
Right.
But he's not commanded to do tshuva. That's correct.
The second thing is also, you can also see this in the story in Gemara where
let me just insert a little tricky footnote. If you think, as some Rishonim write explicitly, that logic commands, and if you think that logic requires you to do tshuva, like Rabbi Yoma says, you put those two ideas together, then he would be commanded. Okay, that's a footnote for the scholars.
Yeah,
I've always got to have a tape here. You know, who knows who's going to listen to this thing? Maybe somebody with training is going to listen to it.
Yeah, but just there's a story about Tanner and Amora, but when the Romans were going through the people in Israel, there's a story that one of a Roman soldier took a rabbi and was throwing him into a fire. He had a wet wool around his heart, and so the soldier asked him, if I take away the wool, will I get it all in my bone? And the rabbi said, yeah, and so he did. And so they both in the Moscow came out and said that the soldier went all in my bone. So obviously, you see, he's a Jew, but he's not Jew, and he gets into all in my bone.
Yeah, but that wasn't the proposition. The proposition was not whether or not you get into Olam HaBa. The proposition was, can your tshuva remove the punishment for your crimes?
That isn't a crime.
He's talking about what he can infer from this story. The fact that he is going to get into Olam HaBa doesn't mean that as a prelude he won't be punished for the crimes that he's done. Many, many people are going to Olam HaBa, but they will spend time in Gehenna to take off the results of the crimes they've done, and then through that purification, they'll be ready to go to Olam HaBa. We're talking here about taking off the need for any kind of punishment. That's what tshuva does for a Jew.
Doesn't it say that they went into Olam HaBa immediately?
I don't think so. Muzmanim Olam HaBa. I don't know if that implies that they'll get in without that. If so, if it would be so, you're right. It's been suggested to me before, but I didn't see any proof that there was no preliminary in Indiana for the things he did that wrong.
So the non-Jew have the same capabilities as the Jew to do tshuva, or is it different capabilities, or how does that work?
I don't know that there are any special... One second. I've never seen it discussed in those terms exactly. I could make a speculation, but I have no basis for it, so I'll just leave it. No, I have not seen any discussion of this question at all. Yeah.
Where does Noah and the destruction of the world come in as far as your early discussion?
Oh, thank you very much. That's correct. Yeah, I skipped the stage. Very good. Noah, the whole world is drowned. You have Noah and his children. God speaks to all of them and gives them the new set of commandments and gives them the blessings, and no distinctions made there whatsoever. No distinctions made there whatsoever. Well, let's see, 1 second. That's right. That's a continuation of the time of the roots, but it's a continuation of the time of the roots. But you're right, because mankind is narrowed down again, the bottleneck, and what comes out is given a chance, everybody treated the same. So I think that's right, yeah.
Why can't non-Jews keep Shabbos?
Why can't non-Jews keep Shabbos? The Torah calls it Osi Benihu Ben Israel. It's a sign between me and the Jewish people. There's a whole philosophy here. I'll just tell you a little bit. Because it's one step away from my main concern, but I'll tell you a little bit since you asked. There's really a tricky point here. What does Shabbos commemorate? What does it stand for? Sorry? Yeah, I mean, but so what? Seventh day, what does that stand for? What does that commemorate? It's the creation, right? It's the ending of the process of creation. When you celebrate Shabbos, you are giving testimony that God created the world. Now, don't the Chinese also live in the world God created? Yes, they do. Well, wouldn't it be just as relevant for the Chinese to testify to the creation as it is to the Jews? Yes, it would. So when God is commanding the mitzvot to the world, and he has mitzvot for Chinese people, the 65 that are vowed for the non-Jewish world apply to the Chinese people. So why didn't God include Shabbos as one of them? I can understand why God didn't include Pesach for the Chinese. They weren't the slaves in Egypt, and they didn't undergo the Exodus. I can understand why he didn't have Sukkot, so that they didn't wander in the wilderness with the protection of the clouds. But Shabbos, which celebrates the creation of the universe, that's just as relevant to them as it is to us.
Was the world created for the Jews? The Chinese just pawns, aren't they?
Well, given what I told you, the first half hour, it doesn't sound like it was created just for the Jews. It was created for all of mankind, and in the end, it's only the Jews that carry it. That's what I told you, that there were three or four stages where God tried to reach everybody.
Christians and the Muslims have the equivalent of Shabbos. They get that from the Jews.
Which is a terrible crime. They should not have done that. And according to most opinions, what they're doing is wrong. God does not want them to do that. Shabbos is supposed to be a special sign between him and the Jewish people. Right? Let me finish this description, and then I'll take your question. Now, so why is it that only the Jews celebrate it if its theme is as relevant to everybody as it is to us? The answer is that a universal theme can only be celebrated by someone who's identified with the universal truth. Someone who isn't identified by the universal truth can't celebrate the universal theme. The fact that a theme is universal doesn't mean that it's equally relevant to everybody. It doesn't mean that. Any more than you would say, since everyone is interested in health, everyone's equally qualified to be a doctor. That doesn't follow. Yes, everyone's interested in health. It might even be that everyone's equally interested in health. Doesn't mean everybody's qualified to be a doctor. Doctors are people who dedicate their whole lives to this theme that everybody's interested in. Other people are interested in health, interested in money, interested in pleasure, interested in power.
Therefore, becoming a doctor is a privilege. Therefore, one should become a Jew and keep Shabbos if it is a privilege.
Perhaps. I don't know if I would necessarily go with the therefore, but the conclusion is certainly true. So only he who can portray, relate to, is dedicated to that universal theme, is chosen to celebrate Shabbos. Now, that means you have to portray it as it was in reality. It means to understand that the creator of the universe, who is also the giver of the Torah, who is also the one who's the source of all spirituality, etc., etc., is the one whose creation you are celebrating by keeping Shabbos. It's not advanced industrial legislation, take a day off for rest so that you work better the rest of the week, the way reform movement has it, and other benighted groups, and the other mistaken applications of it that other groups have. If you have that mistaken application, you're not celebrating it, even though it's truthy, this is relevant to you as everybody else, but you're not celebrating it. And Mimela, it's not relevant to you as a holiday to celebrate. So that's the brief idea of why it's relevant only to us. Yeah.
If we're filling the role, what's the role of the rest of mankind now?
Say that again, if we're what?
If we're filling the role that was intended initially for all of mankind, so what's the role of the rest of mankind now?
We are fulfilling the whole of the role that was initially intended for all of mankind. And they are fulfilling part of the role that was initially intended for all of mankind. Yeah. No, it doesn't follow, although it's a nice question.
Wasn't there not ultimately free will of the rest of the people when there was a choice? We had this discussion a few months ago.
Yes. But listen to his question. His question is, how do you portray God as having an intention different from what happens if he knows beforehand what's going to happen? How can he intend something that he knows is not going to happen? Especially when you're talking about God with unlimited power.
Well, he intended for us to stay in the Garden of Eden and for other not to eat from the tree.
Then how come it didn't happen?
But his intentions never stayed the same because it wasn't free will, you know, his free will and his temptation.
His intentions changed. God's intentions changed.
Well,
we're talking about God's intentions now. I was describing God's intentions. Well, this is very important. When we speak about God's intention, or God's primary intention, and secondary intention, so forth and so on, we're not talking about a change of mind, and we're not talking about the fact that he wouldn't know what's going to happen. What we're talking about is his primary concern and his secondary concern. We're talking about the hierarchy of his values, the hierarchy of his priorities. This is the same as a question which I've answered for you, I've discussed this a number of times in different guises. When Reuven Schwartz buys and eats the bacon cheeseburger, what does God want? Does God intend that Reuven Schwartz should keep kosher?
Yes.
So how come he gets away with eating the bacon cheeseburger? Is he strong enough to fight against God? Can he resist God's power? On the other hand, you want to say that God doesn't intend that he should keep kosher, then why do you tell him to keep kosher? So the answer is that God intends that Reuven Schwartz should freely choose to keep kosher. That's what God intends. That's God's highest priority, God's highest desire, that he should freely choose it. Of course, that's God's highest priority, that he should freely choose it. God can't bring it about. He can't force it on him. Then he's not getting what he wants. God wants him to freely choose it. Now, what happens if that's not going to happen? Because Reuven Schwartz raises the skull and crossbones and says, I'm a pirate, I'm doing as I please, and I'm eating bacon cheeseburgers. So then God has to go for second best. Second best is, I want him to be able to exercise his free will, because that's the only way in which mankind can perfect themselves, and therefore I'm going to give him the power to be able to eat the bacon cheeseburger. That's God's, what you could call, secondary intention. They're both his intentions, and by placing one above the other, you find out what is God's higher value and what is God's lower value. And that's exactly what you have here also. You can say he intended for us to stay in the Garden of Eden. That means God intended that we should freely choose to obey him in the Garden of Eden and stay there. Now, my statement was God's intention was to reach all of mankind, given that they freely choose to respond. If they don't, then God goes to plan B. Okay? Omniscience has nothing to do with that. It's true then he knew what was going to happen. But we have to know what the hierarchy of priorities is, what the hierarchy of values is. Only that way can we understand how God looks at the world, what he cares about, what he doesn't care about. Yeah.
As far as part goes, how could he not be held liable?
How can he be held liable for not doing tshuva? Well, what about 1 through 5? Well, what would happen if a person, through his own free will, puts himself in a condition where he can't exercise free will anymore? And when he's in the latter condition, he does damage. Would he be responsible for the damage? By drinking and then driving. And then he smashes the car. Is he responsible for smashing the car? He was blind when he was driving. He didn't see the pole. He couldn't see the pole. He was unable to see the pole. It was impossible for him to see the pole. Is he responsible for hitting the pole? Is he responsible for hitting the pole? Yeah, because he took steps to make himself unable to exercise his free will. Now, pushing God to the wall also is taking steps to lose your free will. Indeed, Maimonides says the whole reason, but one reason that God went through this with Paro and didn't just kill him was to teach us that if you push it too far, this is the kind of response you can get. Okay, y'all with me? There we go. So now, what is our attitude towards the non-Jewish world today? Attitude is, number one, that we're all made to tell Elohim and God, sharing God's something of God's character, something of God's properties, and though there are differences, because we have 613 commandments, that's our responsibility, of course, our given the capacity to relate to that. We have a responsibility for all of mankind's understanding, but as I'm sure you all know, we don't have responsibility to try to convert them. Now here, again, there's a lot of misinformation. I'll put the record straight, even though it will infuriate the liberals who are in attendance who will listen to the tape. That's because they really need to be infuriated. Does Judaism tell us to go out and convert non-Jews? No, definitely not. Indeed, if a person offers himself for conversion, we're told to resist. Try to convince them that it's not a good idea. Emphasize the difficulties. Well, some people say, if we are not in the business of converting people to Judaism, it must be that we are content with the pluralism of different religions in the world, since we're not trying to convert everybody to Judaism. We must be happy that there are Hindus, and that there are Christians, and that there are Buddhists, and all the rest. No. It doesn't follow. That's not true. It's not true. The truth is a middle ground. There is only one reality, and that is the reality as it is described by the Torah. A person who is out of touch with that reality is tragically unfortunate. Now I'll teach you how to be a real liberal, to be a real humanist. If you know a community that has a polluted water supply, that's terrible, right? Wouldn't it be worthwhile, other things being equal, to try to clean up their water supply? Definitely would. If you know people that are starving, that's terrible, right? Wouldn't it be appropriate to try to ship them food or teach them agriculture so they wouldn't starve? Yes, it would. If you know people whose ideas are out of touch with reality, and so their actions are self-destructive and wasteful, that's a tragedy, right? Right. Wouldn't it be appropriate to try to give them the correct information so that their actions will be productive and successful? Yes, it would. Providing water is important. Providing food is important. Providing truth is important.
So why aren't we going around like these like Christians and other thoughts?
You probably could have anticipated that I was going to answer that in the next 120 seconds or so. So we definitely have a responsibility for the knowledge and understanding of the rest of mankind. And no, we are not happy that Hindus pledge allegiance to 32 and a half gods. and the Buddhists don't have any God at all. Well, that is, that's the way it was originally, and then they had a schism, and now some of them think Buddha was a God, which is also bad. And the Christians, with the three-in-one package and all the rest, we're not happy with that. And the Muslims who think that Muhammad was a prophet, we're definitely not happy with that, because they're out of touch with reality. And Isaiah says that we're supposed to be an Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations, which means to bring them the knowledge that the Torah is true. Only, let's say we succeed, and everybody knows that the Torah is true. The Torah doesn't tell them to convert. So if it doesn't tell them to convert, should we go out and try to convert them? That's not in the package. So we have a responsibility that everyone in the world should know the truth. We're not happy that people live their lives based on falsehood. Now, we wouldn't be happy even if the Torah didn't tell us to be a Or LaGoyim, a light to the nations. It's just tragically unfortunate to live with a life based on falsehood. But the Torah tells us that we should be an Or LaGoyim, a light to the nations. Now, having said all of that, how high a priority is this for us? To teach the world how the truth and how they ought to live. Should we risk death for this mitzvah? Is this mitzvah worthy of risking death? Well, there were many times in history, I would say, obviously, the first thing in history up until the present time, where a Jew who will go to a non-Jew and try to get him to give up his non-Jewish religion would be putting his life in danger. They don't like that. And I think we can understand very well why they don't like it. And by the way, American Reform is now preaching active proselytizing because their movement is falling apart, because they know that in another generation they won't have anybody left, and all the tricks of reducing the mitzvahs and pretending to be social missionaries and all the rest haven't succeeded in pulling the Jews. So now they are preaching active proselytizing, and I am very afraid. Sending out missionaries to convert non-Jews to Judaism. Although, they qualify by saying, we're going after the unchurched, meaning non-religious Christians, you know, Christians who don't belong to a church. Christians will not like that. They've been missionizing us for 2,000 years. They're the majority, we're the minority. Majority has rights, the minorities don't have. So, I think it has usually been a combination of being too dangerous and an almost hopeless uphill battle to preach to the non-Jews to try to convert them away from being practiced as a non-Jewish religion. But if they show any interest, we definitely have a responsibility to do it. There is an international group called B'nai Noach. They have a website, or maybe two. Up on the net, and they have. There was a famous case about 10 years ago of a minister, a pastor in the South, who came to the conclusion that Christianity is false, and he took half of his congregation. There was a whole fight who would get the church building, you know, they were trying to make it into something else. And there was a convention here in Jerusalem about 8 years ago. With a large group of these people, and they had weeks of consultations with the chief rabbis. How does a non-Jew live according to the Torah? There are books on the subject. This is the group that is taking up that position of a non-Jew. In fact, I'm told that there's a fellow in America someplace who goes around from Shabbaton to Shabbaton with Kiruv organizations to tell the non-Jews in the audience, listen, I'm showing you, I'm sorry, to tell the Jews in the audience, I don't have to keep Shabbos, but you do. You're born Jewish and I'm not. I believe in God, you ought to believe in God. That's a pretty powerful message. Hard for a rabbi to get a message like that across. Much easier for a non-Jew to say, look, I believe it, you know. I'm telling you what you have to do. Yeah.
How can you encourage non-Jews to believe in the truth of the Torah without
I guess your question is really psychological, but I think what should be done, if a non-Jew shows interest, and this is what in fact is done, if someone shows interest in conversion, we tell them, listen, this is the truth. First thing to do is learn the truth about what God wants from you, and see whether that's enough.
No, but before they show interest in converting, just like if someone, if a know, Andrew asked the question, like, when, like, just getting them involved in Torah, in Torah, what did that encourage them to convert?
It might, and then if you want to play the game straight, you ought to cut that off at the beginning. Say, listen, I'm teaching you this because the Torah has a program for non-Jews, and I have a responsibility as a Jew to share that program with you, and I'm teaching it to you because you as a non-Jew need to know about this. But tell them right at the outset. Give them one of the many books on the laws of the Noahite group, so he'll know what the responsibilities are. Let him know at the beginning that that's an option. Don't let him think that the only option is conversion. He has no appreciation of this because I don't think there's any other religion that functions like this. You're either in or you're out. Here we have this, what could be called fellow traveler status, what we call Geratosha. Where you believe it, and you are recognized by God, and you fulfill the commandments that He has for you, and you get a reward in the world to come, without joining, you know, to be a full member of the court. Okay, so if you go to acquaint him with the fact that that status exists.